We're going to be having a. I'm going to be interviewing Subhankar, with some key, thrilling questions. I should probably, first of all, I'll have to talk about those 29 days in the tent. You guys weren't even Zen students, were you? You didn't have any meditation techniques, anything. You were just talking about grub, right?
No.
22 hours a day sack time. And
pretty much. Yeah. I mean, it was truly a remarkable experience. I believe moments like that truly makes you appreciate what we value in life. Yeah. Because life becomes so simple. You cannot think about, oh, you cannot hear me? Can you hear me? Okay, is this right? Okay. So those are the moments where life becomes incredibly simple because we cannot do anything else. Blizzard is blowing. The tent cloth is literally 6 inches from our nose and we are lying down. All we can do is appreciate friendship and what we have. No greed, no nothing. Just enjoy the moment. And truly you start appreciating. After I came back from the refuge, those are the experiences truly changed my life because now I have a difficult time dealing with society, cars, buildings, and values very simple things in life. And the land really truly changed you. Like, Peter, you know, you have traveled every corner of the globe. And those are the experiences that stay with us.
Well, I'm still interested in the 29 days.
Okay, 29 days. Well, typically what would happen?
I just wanted to make sure that it didn't take 29 days because you were snoring so loud that the polar bear couldn't come anywhere near.
No. Okay, two things.
I know for a fact that there are some Zen students in the audience tonight. Welcome. And we could feign you a bit so the next time you get in a tent for 29 days.
I have to take your classes.
Okay, good. All right. I'm also curious about, we know we've talked and you've read about Subhankar's past, and he's talked about it too, and the scientific background. And it's interesting that he did, as a kid, apparently he did a lot of painting, and that, you know, evoked that creativity that you certainly show in these wonderful photographs, stunning photographs, really.
Thank you.
And I'm curious to know, since your photography, and this was your first photography, as you say yourself, you'd never printed a photograph or done anything before this happened, which was, you did go on a pack trip, I know you talked about, up in the mountains of New Mexico, and which came first, the photography or the wildlife? What was the seed of it, which actually triggered you, do you think?
I think the first thing was the land. Right after I came to New Mexico, I did this one backpack trip in the Gila National Forest, and I hated every minute of that trip because my friend introduced me, I was a city boy in Calcutta, introduced me, he and his current wife. The land came first. I hated every minute of that trip because carrying a big backpack, going up and down the mountain, I thought it's a very stupid activity. Until I came back to Las Cruces, and my life was changed. So the land came first, falling in love.
It was really kind of an evolutionary process.
It was truly an evolutionary process.
One led into the other. They're not separate.
Right.
Really. Yeah.
And the art was with me all my life, and something that I was struggling to get back, combining art and outdoors.
Yeah.
But it was truly an evolution.
Yeah. I think we've already covered the Arctic story in many ways. I mean, how this happened and how Robert fortuitously showed up and Sarah and all the friends you have in the traditional community up there and all that. And a businessman named Tom Campion, who I hope would be here this evening, he runs a board business. He's ski boards and all sorts of board business in Seattle, sporting thing. And Tom is just a fanatic about the Arctic Refuge, and he puts a lot of spare time and money into helping protect Gas National Forest, of course, which is another one that's being on the point of being looted drastically, and the Arctic Refuge and so forth. And it was Tom who sponsored Subhankar, and Tom And thank you, Tom, who paid for my visit to the refuge and that of my son, my young son, Alex, my younger son, who is also, he was an environmentalist. He's the keeper of the Hudson River. He's the Hudson River keeper right at this moment and doing great work there. No need to clap. That was boasting. You don't clap for that.
Really enjoyed time spending time with Alex in the field.
Yeah, he's a lot of fun. And he had a great time in the refuge. And then, you know, Sumanka, you had a lot of luck meeting Helen, as you say, somebody who took you on sight unseen, and everything, you know, kind of worked out for him. And then, of course, and he got me up there, and he got David Sibley and George Schaller, who worked on the Steenjuck with the Murrays. He wrote a chapter, and he had very, very good people, you know, working for him. Then he ran into a lot of trouble, as you know. After we came back and we'd put it away and the book was coming out, and the book, in fact, was out in the early editions, it came out, it was supposed to, the Smithsonian got very, very interested in this set of photographs for a display for the centennial. And they gave it a very, very big prominent position. They were enormously excited about it. It was going to be on the main floor, just off the rotunda. It couldn't have gotten more prominence, possibly. About 2 months before it was supposed to open at the Smithsonian, the hearings came up about the Bush-Cheney energy bill. And as you know, favorite thing on that energy bill is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for reasons which become more and more mysterious. But nonetheless, the Enron, Exxon, Halliburton combine and the energy bill thing deemed fit to destroy this place. So anyway, the bill came up on the Senate floor, and to her great credit, Senator Barbara Boxer of California had seen Subankar's book. Helen Cirillo sent it out to all of the members of Congress, and she was outraged. And she stood up famously on the floor and waved it around and said, more or less to the effect, do you people really want to trash this place for your children and grandchildren for 6 months' worth of oil? 6 months is not our estimate. 6 months is the estimate of the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey. Very, very technical, bureaucratical, accurate outfit. And 6 months, they feel at the outside is all this coastal plain, this key 1002 area, the calving ground, everything that Subankar was showing us. That's all that can produce. It seems crazy. And it's been going on. It's the longest environmental fight in this country. It's been going on for 25 years. I first saw this region back in doing a book called Wildlife in America back in the 50s, and I've been working for it, trying to get interest in it, National Resources Defense Council, for a very long time. This is a very, very old, very bitter fight. But it didn't really reawaken until the Bush Senior and Bush Jr. They seem to have fastened on this thing. For our current president, it was the only environmental plank. It was kind of an obsession, like Saddam Hussein. So this happened. So this came up on the Senate floor. Senator Boxer said this thing, and she actually pretty much, I think, single-handedly turned that vote. It was a very, very close vote.
Thanks to Senator Boxer.
Thank you, Senator Boxer, because she really, we can't forget that. She's a key figure in this, really. And this is what happened in this interesting situation we find ourselves in this country today. Senator Stevens of Alaska, who with Senator Murkowski persists in saying that this place is a desert and so forth, not worth saving or anything like that. He stood up on the floor after that vote and he said, I am the head of the Senate Appropriations Committee. And I know exactly who is here today and how you voted, and you're going to hear about it. This is the way they work these days, as Fran Maurer says in the, you know. 2 days later or 3 days later, whatever, the Smithsonian calls up Helen Cirillo and the small publishing house in Seattle and says, we're going to, first of all, they said that we want to disconnect ourselves from any connection with Subankar Banerjee and him and his work. Then they backed off that one and said that they were just going to move the show, just, you know, usual Smithsonian, you know, museum protocol. They just were going to happen to move it downstairs behind the men's room and the basement. And cut away all the descriptive material and so forth. In other words, they said they were going to gut the show. which they pretty well did. And Senator Stevens was fulminating against Sabankar. And Sabankar called me up. I'll never forget that phone call. Poor guy, here he is. He's committed his whole life, all of his time, all of his money, 29 days in the tent. terrible sacrifices, you know, for this cause. And, you know, now he's sort of, I'm going to talk about that, but now he's an activist. But at that time, he was really innocent of anything like that. He didn't know about politics, from politics or about him or anything. And he wasn't entirely wrong to fear that. He felt at that time his status in the country was pretty shaky. He certainly wasn't a citizen, and he felt that his visa and everything else was threatened if they got too punitive. And we have seen in recent weeks, these people can get very punitive. We've seen what they're doing to Richard Clark and Richard Foster of the Medicare man and others. People pay a very big penalty for going up against these guys. And he... And the fun-loving John Ashcroft could easily have, you know, penalized poor Sabankar. On top of that, he was $100,000 in debt. And I don't blame him. He was just scared to death. He was.
I was, very much so.
Yeah.
I was afraid of my life, too.
He was, yeah. And not entirely without cause, you know. In fact, very sensibly, I'd say. So he told me about it, and I said, listen, you guys have got to fight this. Don't take it lying down. You've just got to stand up and fight, and we'll get some egg on their face, and maybe they'll back down. And I got hold of a woman named Eileen McQuiggan. She's another hero. She's an editor at Newsweek magazine. And I told her this story. I said, this is a real outrage. One of our most revered national institutions, the Smithsonian, has caved in on this thing. And they are really undoing this poor guy and undoing the show. And she and Kathleen got going, and then she did a feature piece on the Newsweek feature page. Well, of course, the Times picked up on that. Why the hell didn't we know this story? And they got it a half big, very an excellent half-page interview article by Timothy Egan. And the LA Times picked up on that, the Boston Globe. And the next thing you know, was on the map, and Senator Stevens was jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin, and the Smithsonian was saying, we had no pressure from the White House, you know, as we are swamped with truth these days coming out of there. There was egg all over the Smithsonian's face, and to my delight, I think the person really who caved in first was the director. I think they call him the secretary of the Smithsonian, a gentleman named Lawrence Small, a former CEO of, I think it's sort of Fannie Mae Enterprises, just the person to be the head of the Smithsonian.
He was convicted this year.
Wait. Lawrence Small, I've already heard separately and quite separately from this, has just ruined the morale of the Smithsonian. He is just, every interest is financial. Everything is for the Bush administration interests, you know, the CEO and all that. The guy has been ruinous for the Smithsonian. And he's, I think, is the person behind their quick cave-in. Lawrence Small, I'm not displeased to say, has been convicted in recent months. Is serving 2 years probation on felony charges of having been importing wings, other body parts of endangered bird species from all over the world.
All over the world.
This is our current head of the Smithsonian. Now, which goes very appropriately with the other heads of people we have here. I'm very pleased because also a man who sued me for $24 million, Governor Janklow of South Dakota, has also been convicted on all four counts of And so justice occasionally comes around. Anyway, I don't want to stress that. But anyway, this whole thing, the political thing, really started turning around. The California Academy of Sciences got interested, but Sabankar was still in very deep, hot water. Another wonderful, fortuitous thing happened. I'm a part-time, I lead wildlife safaris for a wonderful outfit out of Austin, Texas, called Victor Emmanuel Nature Tourists, Vent Tours, a wonderful group of people. And I was on one this summer, and who should be aboard but Patrick Lannan and Bill Johnston, his right-hand man. And they're both fanatic birders. And I told them about this outrageous story, and I didn't think they were all that interested in it. They said, well, we'll get back to you, or something like that. But boy, did they get back, and have they done a wonderful thing here. Really. And I was telling Patrick that in 50 years on the environmental battle lines, working with the environment, working with American Indian people, all that, this is one of the very, very rare victories. This is one of the really rare ones. So you are really lucky to be here in the presence of this wonderful fellow here tonight. Next question. I'm sorry. did you ask me a question? I'm not a good interviewer. I have to stop that. I get talking here. I see this clock going like mad. What time are we supposed to be over? I got to watch the clock.
It's still almost 8 minutes. Seven something left. Still 8 minutes left.
8 minutes?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. I wanted to ask you, we may go over a little bit. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, John. Well, I'll skip that question. Where the hell are my questions? Oh, yeah. This interests me a lot. Because, as I say, Sabankar was the innocent party here, really, because all of the people who wrote for him were shaking their fists at the administration and maybe helped get him in hot water. He's changed a lot. You weren't a birder, really.
That's true.
And you weren't an activist. Would you consider yourself an activist now?
Now I am.
You are.
Before I was not.
Great. That's exactly right. It's a wonderful thing. No. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And at what?
Well, you helped me become one, because that one, I'm serious, when you gave that courage, go fight it out, stand up. We were scared. Fight it out. Hmm.
Well, and now...
For me, it was an inspirational story. Now it's activism.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's wonderful, because this is such an important thing in this fight. And this fight stands for so many other fights. Mm-hmm. So I hope you feel good about it.
Oh, yeah.
Because I sure do. that clock, that terrible clock. I want to hear one of the things that Sabankar is going to do with the Lannan grant, that's enabled him to do, is a project in India, a 5-year environmental project, which is terrific, because India is one of the most exciting countries in the world right now for the environment. Asia is really coming around to it, and they have such a wealth of wildlife. It's incredible, even with the overpopulation and everything. Tell us just a little bit about what you would like to do
so
there.
Part of the Lannan Fellowship is I'll be launching a project, hoping next year or maybe year after, soon after, a 5-year project to look at the overarching theme is social and environmental impacts of globalization. That's impacting India is going through an incredible transition, to say the least, incredible transition. And what I would look at would be primarily the dispossessed communities and their lives. There are 400 million people live below the poverty line. And the definition of poverty line is a family of four making $18 a month. But money isn't the only issue here. There are things that press and media will never talk about. And I don't want to give out all the things either, because I'm just learning. As a matter of fact, the thing this India project struck me when I was reading your book, and I'm serious, the birds of heaven travel with cranes, that Peter wrote, and there was a chapter on Gujarat. And I said, oh my God, this is amazing story, the story you wrote there. I said, well, maybe someday actually I could do a project in India. So this project will primarily look at the dispossessed communities, public health issues, water, food, child health issues, but it will also look at natural heritage, because India has remarkable natural heritage. So look at all of these things, and at this point, I do not know. I never go into a project with really preconceived ideas. I'm reading up like crazy as much as I can, given a little bit of time here and there, with 4 hours of sleep every day. But it's a remarkable country, like you mentioned, and it's going through an incredible transition. There is incredible humanity out there At the same time, there is incredible greed out there that I see. And we cannot lose these places. And we have to also raise awareness about the social issues that the press and media is not interested in covering. P. Sainath, in his book, which is one of the seminal books that I recommend everybody, if you get a chance to read, called Everybody Loves a Good Drought. In his book, you'll find out that situation is actually worse than what you see sometimes in Somalia and Ethiopia, because in India, it's a concept of slow death for these people. And that's remarkable, because media is not interested in something that is not dramatic. So hopefully, I'll start a journey sometime soon.
Great.
Well, and I'm deeply grateful to Lannan Foundation, because I'll be able to launch that project with the support.
Terrific. What do you think, now that you're an environmental activist, what do you think about the prospects for the refuge? What are the prospects of winning this fight?
There is no thinking. We will not lose this place. Absolutely. I don't even... I never have second thought about this place. However, this is one of those battles that will just keep going on and on and on. Like David Brower says, environmentalists have to win again and again and again. The enemy only has to win once. So constant vigilance. And what our hope is, the only reason we will win is because people want it to be preserved. Every poll that has been taken, over 70% of American public wants this place to be preserved.
Even people who could never afford to go there, that's the great thing.
Very few people will ever get to see this place, but it has become a symbolic place that we cannot afford to lose. And what we are bringing in are the true stories from this place about life, about the indigenous cultures, and the politics. And I mean, I don't even have second doubt. Only thing is that we have to work very, very hard. So please call your senators, share the book with your friends, call your friends in other states. The exhibit will be in 16 museums, like I said, this year. Please ask them to go visit it, but we won't lose it as long as you are with us. I mean that literally, yeah, because every critical point in this project, whenever I had come into some difficulty, I had to call Peter Matheson.
When Robert Thompson told me and told us yesterday a really fascinating thing, and if we weren't on such a disastrous time schedule here, I would get Robert up because he would be more accurate about it. But Robert said there's a whole new oil discovery south of Prudhoe Bay, which is, by the way, the biggest industrial site on Earth, has ruined this part, right next to the Arctic Refuge. But they found another place in the National Petroleum Reserve, which they can drill anytime they want. This vast area, far bigger than the Arctic National Refuge. Why are they so intent on this one area in the Arctic Refuge? They have discovered this new place, Robert told me, and they estimate that this place has, 30 years worth of oil, an enormous load of oil on the National Petroleum Reserve, just and quite near Prudhoe Bay and quite near the oil pipeline, so that the finance of drilling there is very, very, very different. So what is this extraordinary, unholy, and unreal pressure? For 6 months' worth of oil, not 30 years, 6 months, and they want to trash this place when they can have this other place at any time with no legal hassle, no big environmental damage. It's not good, but it sure is not anything like those pictures you saw, because I know that area that they're talking about too. So we are going to win this fight.
Yeah, and
no
one other
question. We have to.
One of the remarkable thing in this debate is that there is this tremendous amount of lies going around from our elected officials and from oil politicians. And I'll give you just a couple of examples what we are dealing with. Senator Stevens, very quickly, this is very critical. Senator Stevens
We're going to appeal.
Yeah. We're going to appeal. 2 more minutes. Senator Stevens made a request to National Academy of Sciences to come up with a study about the impact of oil and gas on Alaska's North Slope. This was published in 2003 as a 288-page book called Cumulative Impacts of Environmental Effects of Oil and Gas on Alaska's North Slope. After the report came out, Senator Stevens, who made the request, condemned the report.
Wow.
Secretary of Interior Gail Norton, you want to share that experience, what happened with...
With Gail Norton and Fran Maurer?
Yeah, Gail Norton and Fran Maurer. This is truly remarkable.
Fran Maurer is a friend of ours who was the director of the Arctic Refuge for a long, long time. He's a biologist. He's been there forever. He knows it extremely well. He wasn't the director. He was the head biologist there. When Secretary Norton came up to inspect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, she had very careful instructions from Senator Murkowski of Alaska to, I think, discover that it was, in fact, a blank desert with not a living thing on it. So Fran was the one guy appointed to take her around, and he did. He spent all day with her. He said it was absolutely amazing. The woman didn't ask one substantive question. She never asked. She didn't want to know. She knew what she was going to take back, and she did. She took it back to Senator Murkowski, and it turned out it was complete. Well, in any other realm of life, it would have been perjury. Really, she completely faked the evidence that Fran Maurer gave her, irresponsibly, to forward the agenda of the fossil fuel interests, the Enron, Exxon, Halliburton axis.
I mean, literally, she replaced the entire report. The chief biologist of her own organization sent her with a report from an oil company consultant that she then hired to replace that study. And it showed up as a front page story in Washington Post the same day Secretary Norton was the keynote speaker at the Society for Environmental Journalists in San Francisco. What an irony that was. It showed up in the front page of Washington Post. That's what we are dealing with. So what we are really hoping to do is, like you asked me, I'm an activist. Yes, I'm an activist. But more importantly, I look at this body of work as educating and inspiring people. It's truly about education. If we don't know what's out there, anybody can say anything and we'll probably believe it. So what we are hoping is to inform people what's out there. That's all.
And this is important that you guys do that too. It isn't, you know, just a thing like this. If we all do something, if we all talk to kids we know, talk to everybody we know, this is a very critical time in the history of our country. Very critical. I can't remember a more critical time. And that goes for Watergate, it goes for the whole Nixon, everything. This is a very serious time. And we must educate people. And we must not let them lose their nerve and be propagandized, you know, into submission. Because that's really what's happening. People are scared to speak up. And that's what kind of that's not our country. This isn't a strong administration. I'm sorry, I don't mean to get on my soapbox, but since you're there, I will. I think, in my long, battered life, this is not the strongest, this is the weakest administration we've ever had. You know? weak in vision and weak in almost every consideration that you can think of. And it's, you know, I don't hate them. They're not worthy foes. These people should not be in charge of the greatest democracy that ever existed on Earth. Yeah. Thank you very much for interviewing me, Mr. Mayor. Do you have any last words? It still says 00. Time isn't passing.
It's still 00. Thank you.
No, I'm sorry. I talk too much. I get excited.
It's been a very emotional experience for me to be here with Peter, Helen, Sarah, Robert, Lucy, Kerry. This is just wonderful. And thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Say a few last words. I had my say.